I wanted to start this evening with a story from the teachings of the Buddha. And it's a story about the Buddha talking with a monk. And this monk's name is Bhikkhusati. Bhikkhusati. And the commentaries to the teachings say that Bhikkhusati was actually a king from a neighboring region, who gave up the throne and all of his riches and power over to his son so that he could become a wandering ascetic and just live very simply and develop his spiritual life. He was tired of being the king, basically. And he knew about the Buddha. I guess he had heard about him somehow and was very inspired by his teachings. And so he decided that he was going to be a wandering ascetic following the teachings of the Buddha. But he never met the Buddha, he just heard about it. So that's kind of the backstory. But even without that detail, the story that's in the suttas is really great. So turning now to what it actually says in the Pali Canon, the Buddha is traveling, apparently by himself, and he needs to spend the night somewhere. So he comes to the a potter, and he asks the potter, "Can I stay in your workshop overnight?" And the potter says, "Well," he says, "it is not inconvenient for me, venerable sir, but there is a homeless one already staying there. So if he agrees, then you can stay as long as you like." And the one who's already there is Pukusati, this apparently king. Whether or not that detail is correct. And so, but Pukusati's already there. And so the Buddha goes in and he says very politely, "Can I stay here also?" And Pukusati says, "Yes, sure, that's fine." So they set themselves up on opposite sides of the workshop. And, the Pukusati doesn't recognize the Buddha because he'd never met him, just heard about him. And, we don't have YouTube videos or, even images really, unless somebody had, done a painting or something. So if you didn't know somebody, you didn't know what they looked like, actually. And so he just thought he was another wanderer. So the night comes and the Buddha's, sits up in meditation most of the night. And Pukkusati also does that. And the Buddha notices that. And it says, the Buddha has the thought, this clansman conducts himself in a way that inspires confidence. Suppose I were to question him. So he asks Pukkusati who his teacher is. And Pukkusati says, oh, it's the Buddha. And then the Buddha says, well, have you ever met this person and would you recognize him? And Pukkusati says, no, I wouldn't. And so the Buddha thinks, wow, this person's a follower of mine, but he doesn't really know. He doesn't recognize me. So he says, well, all right, he's a follower of me. And he sat up most of the night. So he's really serious. Apparently, he's pretty serious about this. So he says, why don't I give him a Dharma talk? He thinks, all right, I'll give this guy a teaching. So then he gives Pukkusati a long Dharma talk that includes a teaching on what he calls the four foundations that support an awakened person, different from the four foundations of mindfulness, in case you're familiar with those. This is another set of qualities that we'll talk about in a moment. But they're the four foundations that support someone who's called a sage at peace. And then, so after this long Dharma talk, I'm projecting this now, but I imagine Pukkusati's eyes getting bigger and bigger. And it says in the text that at the end of the talk, the Pukkusati has realized that this really must be the Buddha. And so I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but he bows deeply and says, I'm so sorry, I didn't recognize you. And it kind of goes on from there. But so it's a sweet story, and there's a little more to it, but we'll stop there. So we have this situation, right, where Pukkusati doesn't recognize the Buddha, but through his actions, that is the sincerity and his, meditating all night, We could say that the Buddha, in a sense, recognizes him, recognizes him as a dedicated follower, as someone who is really on the path. And so the result of that situation is that Pukkusati is given a teaching, and it's a rather deep teaching, actually, because he was clearly this dedicated practitioner. It's a pretty much a step-by-step exposition of wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace. Those are the four foundations that we'll get to in a moment. So those are deep qualities: wisdom, truth, letting go, and peace. And so I'll just drop in a little seed to consider, which is that maybe in some way we are drawing forth what comes to us spiritually. Our manner of engagement brings certain results. Yeah, I would suggest that this is how it works. It matters that we're sincere. It matters that we show up to the Sangha tonight, for example. It matters that we're keeping the precepts. And somebody, you never know who will notice that our behavior is in line with the Dharma, and something might appear for us. This isn't anything woo-woo. I'm just suggesting causes and conditions. As another small example, like a very minor subset of this, I was traveling in Sri Lanka sometime before the pandemic, some years before the pandemic, and I went to a retreat center there that was adjacent to a monastery, and the monks would come over and teach the retreats. And I ended up, through various circumstances, I ended up on a retreat that was being taught in Sinhala, which is the language of Sri Lanka, not in English, which I don't speak that language. So I, but you know, I could go to the instructions and the Dharma talks and kind of listen along. And when they quoted the teachings, they actually quoted them in Pali, and so I sort of could catch some of the Pali words better than even than in Sinhala. So that was interesting. But I had a roommate. We were in, multiple rooms with multiple people, and I had a roommate who spoke English quite well, and she took she had compassion for my situation. And so she would, after the Dharma talk, she would give me a summary of the Dharma talk in the room, in our room together. It was very sweet, and so I was impressed. She liked it. It helped her remember the talk. I thought about how Ananda was remembering all the teachings of the Buddha. But anyway, she would say, "Well, this is what he talked about today. There was this, and then this point, and then this sutta he referenced." And as she went along, I would say, I was indicating that I understood the Dharma, because he was teaching straight from the suttas. And so I would say, "Oh, that's this sutta. Oh, that's the one that has the list about such and such." And she, I still enjoyed hearing from her, but I was kind of giving her prompts and clearly connecting with what she was saying. And it just made a nice connection. And so, but then at the end of the retreat, I wasn't sure where I was going to go next. And she said to me, "I was really impressed that you know a lot about the Dharma. It's clear that you're a serious practitioner. What do they know about some Westerner who's shown up?" And she says, "Why don't you come stay at my house in Colombo? I would like to have you for a couple nights." And so, I did that just one night. But that invitation came because I knew something about the Dharma. And, and then things kind of unfolded from there. She gave me some tips about where to go next after that. So, you just sort of never know how your connection to the Dharma is going to open something or provide an opportunity or make a new friend in some way. So back to Pukkusati, it's not about, it's not about asking for anything necessarily. Pukkusati wasn't sitting there wishing to meet the Buddha, "Oh, I'm so inspired by this teacher. I hope he'll show up. I hope I'll get to see him someday." He was just doing his practice, just following his heart and acting in line with that. And look what came to him, in a sense. And then through what unfolded, through getting that teaching, he had some kind of a shift where he could recognize the Buddha. Something changed for him. So I'm now speaking a little bit metaphorically, right? So it's literal that, oh, he got it from the long talk. But maybe there's ways in which we aren't recognizing the Buddha, and then we do at some point. So I want to say a little bit about these four foundations that the Buddha talked about, the four foundations upon which an awakened person or a sage at peace stands, in a sense. So there are qualities, that a free person has readily at hand in the front of their mind. And maybe for the rest of us who aren't quite there yet, there are practices or qualities that we can practice so that we can open the possibility of freedom. And the way the Buddha talks about them in the sutta, each one of them comes with a verb. So that's why I'm asserting that they're practices we can do. So they each come with a verb. So they are not neglecting wisdom, preserving truth, cultivating relinquishment or letting go, and training for peace. And they're all facets of the same thing, of course, but the Buddha likes to tease things apart into strands that are clearly related but somewhat distinct for the purposes of teaching us. So, not neglecting wisdom. I like the way this is phrased because there's an assumption maybe that we already have wisdom, but it's sort of a matter of not forgetting about it. Sometimes we don't remember that we have wisdom, or we don't honor the wisdom that we do have. So we have to remember to not neglect wisdom, not to neglect what's there. And so, what would that mean practically? Well, one of the ways that we could, if we wanted to make it specific, I think there's multiple ways we could do this, but one of them is that there are qualities named that are specifically said to weaken wisdom. That's what it said about them. And you may have heard this list if you've been around the teachings for a while, is that the five hindrances of the mind are said to weaken wisdom. They also prevent concentration, but it says very specifically that they weaken wisdom. So my sense is that if we're allowing ourselves to get caught up in any of these hindrances, which we do during the day sometimes, that would be neglecting wisdom. We know better, but we still get caught up, right? But just to, just to name them as everyday qualities that we do have, not only in meditation, but in our daily life, we may get caught up in sensual desire, wanting things, wanting stuff. And, and it's not like all desires are harmful. Of course they aren't. And in order to live our life, we need to, we need to want dinner, want to clean the bathroom, that's a good one, things like that. So, it's not that we don't have wants all throughout the day and desires that we act on, but when it's a hindrance is when we get zeroed in on it, right? And we get stuck on something that we really want to have happen, or that's when we start not paying attention to people. It's when we make mistakes. It's when we let our mind get distracted and caught up in things. When we really get tight and we suffer for having this fixation on some kind of a sensual pleasure, or this also covers the realm of people wanting somebody to do something or wanting them to say something or not be a certain way, something like that. So there's that. And then there's the ways we get caught up in ill will, the second of the hindrances. That one's more about the realm of people, but it's like, wishing poorly of someone who doesn't behave well, and we sit there judging them in our mind. And we can get really caught up in these things, even with people who aren't there. I mean, it's one thing if somebody's in the grocery store and they do something rude in some way, and then we're irritated by that. But what about somebody who isn't even there? Like we read an article in the newspaper and then we get all steamed up about somebody who isn't present, and we're really the only ones suffering for that. We get all wrapped up in something that we think shouldn't be happening or whatever. So there's all kinds of ways in which we let ill will take over our mind, or we get an irritating email from that relative who always sends us irritating emails, and then we worry all afternoon about devising the perfect the perfect zinger as a response. And that's not a good way to occupy our mind, right? So we can really get hindered in wisdom by these wanting and not wanting tendencies of the mind. And then there's the other, the next two hindrances are related to our energy level. So we can get stuck in sloth and torpor. And that isn't just getting tired, which we all do by the end of the day or sometimes in the middle of the day. But we actually let our mind get sluggish, or we let our body get sluggish. We don't get up and take a walk and regenerate our energy. And so then as a result of that, we are more likely to fall into some of the other hindrances, and we're just not keeping ourselves sharp. We miss opportunities for generosity, things like that. So there's ways in which the mind is not up to that moment. And then the other side is restlessness and worry. Maybe that one's even bigger, right? The anxiousness, anxiety, concern about things, general not settling of the mind. And this is also a big source of suffering. I mean, for some people, anxiety is a huge issue. But even in a sort of a more mundane way, when we're caught up in restlessness and worry, we miss opportunities, we're distracted, we're not keeping our mind present in the right way, and we can make poor decisions on many levels. And then the fifth hindrance is doubt. So that one is especially relevant for practice. It doesn't mean any kind of uncertainty. We often have uncertainty or, trying to figure out if we should do this or that. But getting caught up in doubt, getting hindered by doubt, we might know we have our different flavors of this, right? Some of us do analysis paralysis, where we overthink a decision that we have to make, or we try to convince ourselves that we're not good at practice. We're so bad at this. Probably I shouldn't even be doing it. I don't know why I, et cetera. This teacher, I don't know, and blah, blah, blah. And all of that is, just distraction again. So all of these things prevent us from connecting with the wisdom that we do have, the wisdom that's there available to us, even if we don't feel very wise. Like I certainly have moments where I don't feel very wise, but I try to remember, no, even then, I do have some wisdom. I know some things from doing this practice, from this path, and it's really just a matter of accessing them. So I think not neglecting wisdom is a really nice everyday practice that we can carry in our daily life throughout the day by remembering not to get caught up in things that take us away from knowing that we do have some wisdom. And then there's preserving the truth. So I don't know, sometimes people don't like that word truth. It doesn't mean like an absolute dogmatic kind of truth, and it's our job to uphold that in some way. I would say instead that preserving truth is kind of about protecting the direct experience of this moment by not getting entangled in things like interpretations, projections, distortions. So what is true right now? And then not turning that into something else. So for example, I might get a headache during the day, and that's what's true. I have a headache. But then it becomes, oh no, is this a migraine coming on? My friend just started getting migraines a couple months ago. What if I'm starting to get migraines too? And this goes a little bit into the hindrances, but if at the moment where we start, turning it into an interpretation, we've lost touch with the flow of the next moment. We've forgotten what happened next and next and next. We're no longer present. So we're not really preserving the truth of it was just a moment of pain in my head. And this is so useful for our interactions with people, just staying with what's true, for our meditation practice, where we're just sitting still, thought comes into the mind, instead of picking it up and saying, oh, what's that thought about? Oh no, I need to think about that. We could just say it was a thought. There was a thought at that moment. And now in this next moment, I feel a body sensation. So I think preserving truth has to do with not distorting experience with our ways of seeing things that aren't correct or turning them into being about me. We have all kinds of common distortions. We see things that are impermanent as permanent. Oh, it's going to be this way forever. We see things that are really suffering as happiness. This is great, but actually, we think our anger is really great, but actually, it's suffering. We see things as self that are not self. Basically, nothing is self, but we make all kinds of things into ourself. It's all about me. It says something about me. Oh no, people are going to see that I'm a terrible person, or oh, I hope they see I'm a wonderful person through doing this. And we're just caught up in distorting the reality of the moment. So preserving truth, I like also as a simple practice that we can just stay in touch with how things are and try to refine our ability to see how things actually are. And then there's cultivating relinquishment, or sometimes it could even be seen as the flip side of that as generosity. And at first we may cultivate letting go with some kind of personal effort. And then later, though, it maybe becomes a little bit more effortless as we've practiced not neglecting wisdom and preserving truth. It's easier to let go and just let things flow moment to moment. Be available to give what needs to be given or do what needs to be done or not do if something doesn't need to be done. And then there's training for peace, which I think again is pointing toward the present moment. It's not like we're training with a future-oriented idea. It's maybe a sense that peace is already here and we're training to be able to see it and connect with it more clearly. Can we find peace in this very moment? And that has a lot to do with understanding that we don't have control over everything. That's part of wisdom and part of preserving truth is that, yeah, I don't have complete control over this moment. So we have to be able to find peace now, right now, with whatever's happening. And the Buddha points toward a peace that's not dependent on conditions being the way we want them to be at every moment. And even the Buddha couldn't control his life, right? He had an attempt on his life by his cousin, and he had back pain and other things. So even without that control, though, we're told the Buddha was at peace all the time. So if we found something in this very moment, it didn't depend on things being the way he wanted them to be. So all of these trainings, in my interpretation, are founded on a quality that we might call recognizing our own goodness. So we have to recognize that we have wisdom, first of all. Recognize that we can connect with the truth of the moment, that we can let go. Recognize that peace is possible here. There's something important in Buddhist practice about recognizing what is valuable or wholesome, what's good right now, and then daring to live by that. Pukkusati, going back to our friend, he gave up being the king. That's a big letting go, because he recognized that he wanted to live by the values he had discovered in his heart. And being a king, it was okay, but didn't allow him to do that completely. So he got his son to be the king so he could do more of this living in line with his values. So there's something about recognizing goodness here and now that helps to open something. Helps to open the next step. It helps to open a way that we can move forward or move into. And part of this recognition, now to get a little bit specific, is to be aware of our own wholesome qualities and values and our value, our literal worth, our value in the world. And we may not be doing this sufficiently. For my students are not sufficiently recognizing their own wholesome qualities, which I think is, it's helpful to be able to do that. And I have I'm not just making this up in the sense that the Buddha recommended specifically in different teachings a number of what are called recollection practices. And these might be new to you if you've really mostly done mindfulness and metta and the kind of more standard things that were taught. But he had some teachings where he specifically said for us to recollect in certain ways, think. We're actually supposed to think in certain ways in these practices. And there's a standard set of recollections that we do, and there's six of them. But I want to focus on two of them, which basically we, all six of them were bringing to mind inspiring themes that are meant to uplift the mind and heart. And we do it deliberately for, you could do it for a whole meditation period, but you can also just do it at the beginning, which is what we did in our sit. I asked you to recollect a time when you had given something. And I did that because two of these recollection practices are dana and sila, which means generosity and ethical conduct. And you could read this and say that we could just recollect kind of abstractly, oh, generosity is such a wonderful thing to have in the world, which is true. But I would suggest a little more pointedly that we're meant to actually recollect specific instances of our own generosity. It does actually say a person recollects their own generosity thus, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, and also our virtue or our ethical conduct doesn't mean we have to be perfect, but we've been recognized that there are specific instances where we acted with generosity or in an ethical way. We all have things like that that we can think of. And, you know, there certainly in the West, there are people who think this is a little bit selfish and is a little bit maybe reluctant to think of those things. But I think it's pretty much in how you do it. So we could recollect our good qualities with a sense of, I'm the greatest thing. Aren't I so wonderful? I'm better than my sister who doesn't do as much of this as I do. You know, obviously that's not going to be very wholesome. But we can just in a nice way recollect a time when we did something good or wholesome or helpful, beneficial, and kind of take that in to our system and like breathe with it or feel the uplift of it in our heart. Usually it can bring a slight smile to the face or a warmth, a feeling of lightness, peace. You have to see for yourself what comes to mind. But just to mention in passing, the Buddha actually did this also. In there's one teaching where he's talking about a time before his awakening. I won't go into the details of the sutta, but he was talking about a time before his awakening, and somebody asked him about his practice and whether it was difficult for him to practice alone in the woods when he was striving for awakening. And he said, well, yes, it is scary to be by yourself in the woods, but what I did was I recollected all of my good qualities, and I remembered that I'm mindful and that I have some degree of wisdom and some concentration, and he names a whole bunch of them. And then he goes on to say, and after I recollected all of that, then I was able to concentrate my mind and go on to awaken. So there it is from the word of the Buddha, is that we can recollect our own good qualities, and it's a support for practice. To support, it improves our practice if we recollect. So I was hoping, I don't know if we'll have a dramatic result tonight, but I was hoping you might have noticed that in your meditation, it went better after you recollected your own generosity. Okay, that's a lot to ask for because I wasn't pointing to it, but consider in the future if that might be helpful if you uplift your mind in some way at the beginning of a sit. I do want to read the language from these recollection practices about what the Buddha says happens after we do a recollection, and then we go on to just do our regular meditation. So he says, after this recollection, one gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dhamma, gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. When one is glad, joy is born in them. In one who is joyful, the body becomes tranquil. One whose body is tranquil feels happiness, and in one who feels happiness, the mind becomes concentrated. Wow. How about that? Simply recollecting your generosity is a condition for concentration, for samadhi. Oh, wow, that's pretty good. So all these years, if you've been struggling to get good samadhi, maybe you should be thinking about your own generosity a little bit more, and then it would become more accessible. But I like it, right? We gain inspiration, and then there's joy, and then tranquility, and happiness, and concentration of the mind. So recognizing our own wholesome qualities is really meant to be a direct support for meditation. And I don't think we have to do anything much. It just says, it sutta pretty much says this just unfolds as a matter of course, which I like. So if you forget everything else about this talk, please good qualities and skillful actions is a good thing to do. All right. Highfalutin, to call them the foundations for a sage at peace, because I'm getting a note that my internet is unstable, so hopefully it's not wavering anymore. So it might sound a little bit daunting that it's somebody who might say, well, I'm not an awakened person, I don't have these foundations to stand on. But I want to mention that I came across a teaching from the Tibetan tradition, and my mind kind of stuck on this teaching when I read it, and I kept thinking, why is that teaching sticking in my mind? And then I realized that it lists the same set of four as are in this Pali Canon teaching, this early Buddhist teaching. And they're a slightly different order, but it's the same list. And in that teaching, they are called the four inspirational blessings, and they're said to be the qualities that support wholesome behavior in our lives. And that sounds much more down to earth, right? And so they're listed as truth, letting go, utter peace, and wisdom. So I read this Tibetan teaching that says these are the four inspirational blessings: the blessing of truth, the blessing of letting go, the blessing of utter peace, and the blessing of wisdom. So all that is just the same list with wisdom transposed from the front to the back. And I thought, okay, that's pretty everyday. If there are inspirational blessings that can are the support for us to have wholesome qualities in our life, that I can do. And so I started paying more attention to how they were appearing in everyday life. I was actually teaching a retreat recently that included a teaching on these four qualities. And so they were kind of on my mind. But there I was, right? I was on a teaching team, one of the teachers for this retreat. And one night at dinner, we were going through the dinner line, and there was dal soup for dinner, and it had some cauliflower in it, like florets of cauliflower, still pretty solid in them. But a bunch of them had sunk to, down to the bottom. And when I realized as I took a scoop of soup that there was cauliflower down at the bottom, I found myself wanting to go for the cauliflower. And so then I was, right there. I could feel my desire. And I noticed my attention like narrowing down onto the pot of dal. And so right there, I was seeing that I was trying to keep myself present, even though my mind was, had some desire in it. And I thought, oh, I'm not neglecting wisdom. I'm remembering that I shouldn't collapse into my desire for the cauliflower. And I had to admit, okay, here I am, even though I'm the teacher on this retreat, sensual desire is arising and preserving the truth, and, admitting that that was what was really going on. Gee, I wonder if I can, if it's unseemly looking, if the teacher is digging down in the pot of soup. Yeah, probably that doesn't look very good. So I found myself letting go, relinquishing the desire for the cauliflower and settling back, relaxing, moving on to the next item in the food line. And so, I was kind of feeling the peace that comes from having gone through that little process and not getting stuck. So right there were the four blessings in that little act of having desire arise and kind of working through it in the moment. So it's a blessing, you know, that these qualities exist in our heart and that we could have moments like that throughout our day, also starting with not neglecting wisdom, with being mindful, for example, recognizing what's going on so we have access to our wisdom. So we just have to draw forth these qualities, I think, by seeing them and then enacting them in some way. The world needs people who are prioritizing wisdom and truth and letting go and peace. And the world is made a better place by our devoting ourselves, let's say, to these qualities. If even just one of these four foundations that we talked about were held in esteem generally in the world would be a very different place, I think. So we can learn just to live from, you know, helpful orientations. And I guess I'd like to suggest that these four are a useful orienting principle for our mind. You know, they're more wise than our usual orientations around getting what I want, avoiding what I don't want, etc. So blessings may come from surprising directions when we do this. And it can be that we may be in our life in touch with, you know, we may be in the presence of qualities like wisdom and truth and peace, but just not quite recognizing them in this moment. Rather than it being a long training where we've got to get to the end of something before we get them, what if they're here right now? It's just a matter of being able to see them. So if we keep sitting sincerely, practicing sincerely, recognizing our own value and our own wholesome qualities, someday you may find yourself in the presence of the Buddha, right there in the potter's shed, and recognizing. So I think I'll stop there, and we have a few more minutes before we'll go on to the metta. So if anybody has any questions or any questions about the practice or about the Dharma, this is a good time. Yeah, Barbara. Oh, you'll need to unmute.
Yeah. I recognizing the truth, I'm muted. My whole thing, I really like the whole idea of recognizing the truth because I think I really don't do that a lot in going through interpretation. So, is there any other ways, any tricks of mindfulness to catch oneself when we are about to spin out from the moment and go into the whole long thing about, oh, I'm on my way to the hospital and I'm planning my own funeral and whatever?
Right. Yes.
I'd love to know it.
Yeah. Thank you. We all have our personal flavors of how we rush off into these projections. For me, I find that one way, in terms of mindfulness that I can start to see my mind doing that is that when the mind is going to run off like that, it has to contract in some way. And so there's kind of a narrowing of the mind and also a little bit of a it's hard to describe, but like almost a feeling of dizziness, or because that's the moment where we disconnect from the present moment. And there's kind of a, yeah, like a, you know, we lift off in a sense, and then we can go. And if you can train yourself to at least some of the time be able to feel that slight disconnecting, it's a little bit like almost a dissociation, and it can be subtle. It doesn't mean like a huge dissociation, but there's like a little bit of a backing off. So that's one thing that I look for. Or if I've gone off into a story, I can feel definitely that there's that non-connection, and then I can point myself toward reconnecting. Thank you.
That's helpful. Thank you.
I can't seem to find the raise hand feature on my computer.
Okay, no problem, Corey.
I'm sorry, did you say what the other four Where?
Oh, so the four are to not neglect wisdom, to preserve truth,
Oh, I'm
to
sorry.
cultivate.
I
Oh.
mean the other four of the six recollections.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so we did Dana and Sila. So the other four are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So those are three of the others. And then the sixth is the unusual one, which is to recollect the devas. And, we don't do that so much in our society, but in specific. Is not the fact that there are heavenly angel beings, but that people are born as devas or beings get reborn in that realm when they have certain good qualities of heart, and specifically things like wisdom, learning, generosity, ethical conduct, a lot of the other things that we also remember. But we remember that there are beings who have done better at this than we have, and we feel
Nice.
inspired by them. Yeah. Yeah, Bill.
Oh, okay. This is more of a comment. I really liked the formulation of not neglecting wisdom. Because usually I think of wisdom as something that is pretty scarce, and that I have to really work hard to drum up some. And that really is more about that wisdom is actually pretty plentiful, but we just tend to ignore it. So that
Yes.
it's very available to us if we would just pay more attention to it. So
Yeah.
I never heard these four foundations before, so this is very interesting. Thanks.
Great. Thank you for the comment. Yeah, very, very true. Mary Kelly.
Hopefully I won't click out. So I really appreciate this presentation, and it the and what you said about the truthfulness. It's to me what I realize is so much of this is about mindfulness, and that whole idea of being present. I mean, I won't know what's true unless I'm really here. And showing up, and like I like what Bill said too about it's like am I available for whatever wisdom is going to be here for me? And so there's got to be a certain clarity of truthfulness that I have there too. And for me, a lot of times it's relinquishing the preconceived ideas about how I have things too, like of what I want. It's just they all tie so beautifully together. And so it's kind of, I'm gonna have to, it's gonna be a post-it note in my house,
Excellent.
because for me, a lot of it is, it's just like, it's, and it's remembering and the recognition are so important. And I really thank you for this as a reminder, and that there is a certain peace that I can have when I'm not in contention with the way things are.
Yep.
No? So I really
Well
appreciate
said.
this. Thank you.
Thank you. Yep.